Hi, everyone. I have an interview coming up in a minute with Dr. Mariana Kaplan, who is a yogi and a yoga teacher, but more importantly, she's a psychologist, psychotherapist, who's written this book on the connection between yoga and psychology, and she's really studied for a long time. You know, I originally contacted Mariana because I wanted to talk about cults, and I wanted to talk about the abuse of these so-called spiritual teacher guru things, as you may have seen in the recent documentary Wild Wild Country, which is really excellent. It's on Netflix, and it's all about Osho and that crazy cult up there in Oregon. There's a lot to pull apart here. We didn't really get into it for a variety of reasons, but we do talk about that. But if you're interested in this topic like I am, let me know, and I might try and find a way to squeeze this into some other shows. Here's my interview with Dr. Mariana Kaplan. Welcome to Skeptica, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. My guest today is Mariana Kaplan, who has a new book, Yoga and Psyche. Mariana, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
I am too. I was so excited to read this book. I'm such a yogi, and I have been such a yogi for so long. And I think that anyone who's ever stepped on the mat and had a sense that more is going on than just these poses, I think, is going to get the gist of the book. But tell us, you have such a fantastic background to write this book. Tell us what you're getting at in the connection between yoga and psychology, and then we can take it from there.
Great. So my whole adult life has been spent studying, practicing, teaching in these parallel traditions, though I really do prioritize the role of student when we're talking about something as vast as yoga or as deep as the psyche, which is connected to the world of psychology.
You're a very practical, pragmatic person, which I think goes with these two together. I mean, most yogis that get on that mat and get on that mat every day and have the discipline to do it become or are by nature very practical, pragmatic. You are, and you also bring that to your psychology work too, to your therapy work. We should mention to people, besides, you know, you've written some other very interesting books that we're going to talk about, The Guru Question, Halfway Up the Mountain, Eyes Wide Open, which is some of the work that initially drew me to you because you are very, again, practical and very forthright in saying, hey, we need to exercise discernment in this spiritual path too. And then there's this other side of you that actually is this people helper side, the psychologist, therapist. And I get the sense from listening to you and reading about your work that you encounter a lot of people in your therapy work who are on this journey, either as spiritual seekers or as yoga students or as yoga teachers. So that's become a whole part of your practice as well, right? Tell people really quickly, before we get into the bulk of this interview, your therapy work and how that, you know, fits into this.
Yeah. So, and I'm glad you asked because I spend 3 days of my life every week for years on end as a psychotherapist. In a broad sense, I will work with and include anyone in my practice because I feel that life is essentially spiritual or spirituality is essentially human, however we put it.
I hope people have a sense for who you are from that introduction. What I was hoping we could do is kind of enter into this conversation, this dialogue, along the lines of what we talk about on Skeptico. And that'll give people listen to this show a reference point to you. Your fantastic book. People got to buy this book. If you stepped under the yoga mat and you've thought there's something more to this, like maybe there's some psychology that's going on. Maybe there's a reason why I start crying halfway through my yoga session. Or the reason, what I see all the time in yoga is people who can't sit for or lie down for a minute in Shavasana. No, they pack stuff up and they want to leave. It's like, do you maybe think something's going on there with you that you feel like you have to leave? You can't sit there quietly for a minute. So these are the things I want to talk about, kind of not directly from the standpoint of the book, but kind of in general. So I thought what we might do is start with some very basic definitions of stuff that people have to know to understand where you're coming from. Psychology. Everybody knows what it is, but tell us what you think it is from the perspective of your work.
So the field of psychology, as contrasted with yoga, yoga is 2,500 to 5,000 years old. Psychology is about 138 years old. And so psychology as a field is emerging, but the psyche, right? So an individuated, unique aspect of the self that's somewhat distinct from this unifying consciousness. It's unique and it's particular and it's individual. And it most likely extends well beyond our individual lifetime into intergenerational
conditions. See, but a lot of that doesn't fall under psychology. And you have the PhD after your name, and you have to, you know, you have friends that go to APA, or maybe you go to APA, you know, there's, so we'll talk, I'm going to put a pin in that. We'll talk about that later. Yoga, real quickly, what is yoga as people understand it? And what is it, you know, you had an interesting experience. The first person that you encountered at a very young age had a much broader, closer to the original definition of what a yogi is. But what's yoga from the standpoint of what most people think yoga is?
Well, that's a complex question. I mean, most people might think that yoga is a set of exercises practiced by thin, flexible people who look, you know, something like a yoga journal cover, right? So many people think of yoga as a series of exercises. And a little funny story, my dad's 86, he's trying to read my book, and he said, I'm really trying to read my book, but the problem is I don't know what yoga is. I'm going to have to look that up. And I said, you don't have to look it up. You can just ask me. I'm right here.
Transpersonal psychology.
Transpersonal psychology has, I did an article with a couple of students about surveying 50 people in the field. So they all had different definitions. but what I would say is that it's a full spectrum psychology. So it attends not only to our, what traditional psychology attends to our relationship issues, addictions, wounds, neuroses, psychoses, but extends into the full spectrum of what is possible for a human being to develop as. And one of the things I appreciate about transpersonal psychology and what it can provide is that as we are opening and becoming more of ourselves, there's new levels of obstacles or challenges. So it's a psychology that attends to all levels of human development and awareness.
Somatic psychology.
Somatic psychology includes the body in the psychology, in the therapeutic process. And I practice this all the time with clients. So psychology starts to drop into the body where our whole conditioning lives inside of our nervous system, right? So yoga does it in a different way. And in my 20 plus years as a therapist, the turning point was my discovery and then training further in somatics, because when we bring the life of the body into our healing of our story, of our wounds, I find that it is more efficient, more enlivening, and often more movement happens.
Okay, and the reason I bring these up is just to be fair or to anchor people. I mean, there's a huge gulf here. There's a huge chasm in psychology between traditional psychology, psychology as we know it, psychology as our kids are likely to encounter it in school, and the kind of stuff you're talking about. And it's not that this gap can't be bridged or that you don't bridge it quite beautifully, but it's controversial to say transpersonal psychology. I've talked to a bunch of those people. I've talked to some of the founders, and they're outsiders. They are outside group, you know, and that's okay. Somatic psychology, the way you said it, is awesome. It's beautiful. I get it that our psyche winds up manifesting itself into our physical being, and that when we move our being, when we move our body in a certain way, when we stretch it, when we breathe, when we do these postures, stuff happens. And that's what you're studying, and that's what you're bringing to the table. And again, like I told people from the book is very practical. In a lot of ways, it's a toolbox. You know, it's like, do this and notice this and see what happens. And you're making the case for somatic psychology. If it is controversial or people are apprehensive or saying, hey, that sounds like new age crap. One, you have the science to back it up. But two, you can go on the mat and see if that turns out to be true. Neuroplasticity.
So that's the principle that our brain is not fixated. Like, the story is not over, that as we change our breath, our posture, our attention, right? Which is all things that psychology addresses, but in some many ways meditation and yoga address even more effectively, that we can actually change our brain as we change.
And let me just interject, because we've talked about neuroplasticity a lot on this show, because I think what a lot of folks don't realize is that it completely undermines science as we know it. It completely undermines this model that we are these biological robots, that we are purely a function of our brain, that we're nothing more. And what neuroplasticity tells us is that I think, therefore I am. But I always get a little bit nervous, even the way you cast it there, when we hear neuroscience types talk about the discoveries of neuroplasticity. I mean, these nitwits discovered neuroplasticity in the same way that Christopher Columbus discovered America, you know? I mean, our best evidence is that the continent over here was here before the guy sailed off on the water. You know, and that's the same thing with neuroplasticity. This is how consciousness works. Consciousness is interacting with the brain, is probably fundamental, and is creating the brain in this co-creation process. So this idea that now we can celebrate because neuroscience has ordained that they've discovered neuroplasticity, it's bullshit. That they've just stumbled across, just like Christopher Columbus stumbled across, what all the real deep wisdoms already knew, is that we are enmeshed in consciousness, and that is reflecting down in our body and in our brain, and that's what's really going on.
Right. I agree with you. And I in fact, attended a training last year with one of the, you know, world's famous neuroscientists. And the conclusion of the 3 days was that social engagement is one of the most healing things in the world. I mean, that's his whole life of study. And for me, what I appreciate about neuroscience, because I'm not particularly a neuroscience buff, I put it in the book because I feel like it's important to include, is that by science validating and studying, right, the effects of consciousness, the effects of yoga, the effects of meditation, it is enabling these things to have, you know, an access point into work with veterans and hospitals and, you know, even as far as insurance. I think we'll see, you know, we'll see a time in our lives where insurance may support yoga, meditation. Like it's the stamp that's connecting these traditions to a more mainstream society, because all the science is backing it. And I think that's pretty great.
Yeah, maybe. Last one, spirituality. Broadly, let's talk about what we understand when we say spirituality.
I think that human beings have an essential deeper nature that we can call spiritual or anything else. And that the choice to access it further and open up to it is there for the taking.
Great. So the basic flow of the skeptical thing is based on these three ideas. One, follow the data, and we'll start there. You have talked about this, interspersed this already in the conversation, but you go to great lengths to point out the data, the science behind what you're claiming, because a lot of folks coming at this not from the yoga community, not from the non-dual community, not from the spiritual community, will, you know, because you live this, they're like, well, I'm not so sure. Make the case for yoga and psychology. What's the science? What's the most compelling science that you cite in the book that you think makes the case?
So with two doctoral students several years ago, I worked to survey all the academic research to date at that time, not only in yoga and psychology, but yoga and neuroscience, yoga and trauma, trauma and psychology, mindfulness and psychology and so forth. And we surveyed over 200 published academic articles and we collected, we summarized it for people. And essentially, there's ample scientific documentation that yoga, even without the psychology, right, this most basic practice of physical postures for a period of time, minus all the extra goodies that I think are so enhancing, addresses and has proven to be beneficial for, just name a handful, anxiety and depression, eating disorders, suicide prevention, autoimmune disorders, well-being, attention deficit disorders. And so there's the huge list. All the science is summarized in a people-friendly book and in a people-friendly way in the book. But basically the science has shown yoga's benefits on most major categories in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that has all it's the most mainstream and useful in many ways text to survey all the psychological disorders known in the Western world. Yoga benefits all of them when used in the right way and the right quantity.
Okay, so the second part of this process, this skeptical process, and this always
it's all new me. And fun. I feel like I'm on a treasure hunt.
Did you watch the video that I sent you?
I didn't have time.
You didn't have time. It was 5 minutes out of your day. You would have seen the whole presentation, so you would have known what's coming. So you're winging it. Decision to wing it. So that's cool. So the second part of this process for skeptics is to look for the conspiracy, because really the conspiracy and truth go hand in hand. Truth seeking is about this bravery to follow the data wherever it leads, because sometimes the data leads us in places that we wouldn't expect. Psychology is a classic example. Here is a book by this fantastic, no, here is my book that I wrote a couple years ago. And the point is that when science gets consciousness wrong, like it has completely, consistently, systematically, intentionally, in that they know consciousness doesn't work in this strictly materialistic way, but they act like it does because it serves certain benefits. Well, when you get consciousness wrong, nothing else really makes sense. And that certainly is the case with psychology. I mean, if we're going to look at psychology more broadly, and I love and appreciate your work as a psychology outsider, but let's get real with the way that most people encounter psychology or may encounter therapy, particularly if they're experiencing the kind of problems, the kind of issues, the kind of spiritual emergency kind of situations that thankfully you're there to help support people in. Most of those people go to the doctor and they're just in the system, man. They're getting a pill and they're saying, take this. They're still getting put down. Maybe it's not quite as direct. It's more subtle, but it's like, you're crazy. There's something wrong with you. And until we're real about this and real about the causes of why psychology has gone down this pharmacological model and has pushed it, even when the data comes back and says, hey, depression, mild depression, these multi-billion dollar industry, it is not more effective than placebo, but we still sell billions of dollars of this. So I love that you say, maybe we'll just grow out of this and keep going, guys. Maybe not. These guys have a strong financial interest in keeping things the way they are. So what are the changes that you've seen in your career, and how can we How can we expedite it? And don't we need to call these people out? It's not all, join hands and sing kumbaya. I mean, there's some devious stuff going on out there in psychology.
I agree with everything you said, right? When we talk about calling these people out, you know, it brings an image of some amorphous them. And for me, like, I don't know how to do that. So I do what I do know how to do, which is...
I know who they are because I talk to them all the time. One of the things I try and do is invite them on the show. And I get NYU professors of psychology. I've had many psychology professors, and they will say categorically that I'm wrong and that consciousness is a function of the brain and here's how it works. And the neurological model is winning and all the rest of that. So it's not just playing around when I say them and us.
Yeah.
But it's them and us. It's an ideological divide that is... If you're giving people high doses of psychopharmacy crap, then you're doing that because you've bought into that model. You're them. That's not to say that there aren't places and instances where it's useful, but I mean, come on, there is a them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't disagree. I was just saying for me, when I look at that, I don't know what to do, but when I... So maybe this is my optimist, but I look at what I can do, right? And I can research, I can write, I can share, I can, you know, touch individuals, I can touch groups, I can touch larger people, larger amounts of people through writing. And when it's done in a very grounded, pragmatic way with some scientific research included, it's going to speak more effectively. And so I don't have the answer to your question. It's like I try to attend to my own garden and, you know, include as many people in that as I can. And when I used to work at California Institute of Integral Studies, graduate school in San Francisco, I, for many years, I put together different lecture series on controversial topics in spirituality. And I would invite both sides to speak. And I always enjoyed that and tried to make some bridges. And now, as the mother of a young child, it's just not what I'm doing right now, but I'm all for you doing it.
You know, I'm always a little bit leery when people say that. Say, hey, you know, that's not my thing, but I'm all for you doing it. It's like, I think we're all doing it all the time. I think that's the truth-seeking process. And I think that you like I say, I am a yogi. I've been a yogi for a lot of years, thousands of classes. And when I show up in the class, I think these issues are there and are very relevant to people and are going on with people all the time. In that, the way I always put it is the "how can this be" question. Mm-hmm. So it's great that you are this entry point, this diving board into the pool. But when they get in the pool, a lot of people pop their head up and they go, "Wait a minute. How can this be? I've been told all this other stuff my life, maybe through my parents, maybe down at church, maybe through my doctor. I have these conflicting views. How do I resolve those?" And I think part of the job is to lay out that landscape and say, you have to understand that there are other forces out there that are acting upon you, and you can decide, you know, which what your reality is, but to pretend that they're not there, I don't think works. And I guess that would lead me into the next.
Yeah, but just to back up on that point, I mean, when I say I'm glad that you're doing that, I don't see the contradiction. I mean, I use, you know, most minutes of the days of my life, you know, to try to, in addition to, you know, taking care of who I'm charged to take care of, to try to support what I believe in. I talk to people on all sides of the spectrum frequently in a public setting. I just don't have a vision of how to take on a them and change it more than the ways that I do it.
That is totally fair, and it's more than fair because the other part of this conspiratorial thing that I think is important to put on the table is the conspiracy surrounding spirituality. And it's something that you have really, you've dived into quite deeply and profoundly and with some real sensitivity that I don't see a lot of people addressing. But if I can kind of set the table in kind of my crude skeptico way, it's that the coexist thing is bullshit at some core level that most people don't acknowledge. I mean, selling 11-year-old girls into marriage is not something we should coexist with. Mutilation, sexual abuse of children, not something we should coexist with. That isn't the goal. The goal is to develop, as you so beautifully talk about in your books, a discernment that is both spiritual and practical in terms of ways that psychology can tell us that we can develop morals that are beyond some little book, that old dusty book that was written long ago. You've written and thought a lot about this and have brought some great stuff to the table. Tell me where you see it. And again, not in the kind of crude beat somebody over the head way that I said, but maybe in your own way, this issue of spiritual discernment and how it manifests for you and your clients.
So as you mentioned right at the beginning of the interview, not my first exposure to spirituality. My first exposure to spirituality, which I tell the stories on myself and several of my books, were when my own psychological wounds were mixing with my own spiritual yearnings, and I was following alcoholic shamans down in Mexico and getting myself into all kinds of gnarly situations that I, you know, eventually came to support other people in doing. But by the time I was 25, I spent a year in the presence of a great yogi who was so vast in his being and not that it just sort of, it not only raised the bar, it just took the bar off. It changed my view permanently. So again, being based in Northern California, I live in the center of right, the whole range of spiritual activity and other activity. So from right at the beginning, I just felt like it was important to get really pragmatic and down to earth and separate out strands. And all my work on pointing out shadows on the path and places of divergence. And it's like all in the service of just greater clarity.
I don't know. I mean, people are encountering spirituality packaged in some very potentially dangerous, destructive ways. Don't we need to acknowledge that? You know, I met you through Rick Archer, who is just awesome. We're going to talk about his show, Buddha in the Gas Pump, in a minute.
God, I have like 2,000 pages of published material about encountering the obstacles, and I mean that's what I've done.
But I get that. But let me give you a concrete example. I just got an email not too long ago from someone who said, "Hey, love the show. Like how you're kind of breaking this stuff down, but I'm kind of wondering. I'm kind of in a little bit of a." You know, upset here because I saw the Netflix documentary, very popular now, Wild Wild Country, about Osho and about the cult in Oregon. And her point was, as a true spiritual seeker, say, I don't know what to do. I heard that Osho, did have a spiritual gift and was able to enlighten, give people the experience of awakening and enlightenment with just a touch or a look, as we hear so many times with gurus who are then found to have other problems in their lives and not be complete people. Where I think we need to be able to go is not address that from this kind of new agey kind of, well, and I don't even agree with what Rick says, you know, hey, take what you can and leave the rest kind of thing. It's like, Osho was a creep. He did creepy things to people. When we come at stuff from, I think that's what psychology can kind of ground us in some ways, is this ability to kind of see shit the way that it is and call it that. And that's where I see you potentially operating and bringing something to this table where you can have a foot in both, but then firmly take a stand and say, look, he was a creep, and it's pretty easy to see that. Scientology is bullshit. We don't need to beat around the bush and, you know, well, you know, respect everyone's beliefs. No, there's a certain practical part of that woman who wrote me the email, as well as what a lot of people deal with. And spirituality and yoga does make it more difficult when we have these kind of unbelievable experiences of opening, of awakening, of deepening. But do you get what I'm talking about, or does any of that relate to?
I'm following you. I'm not sure where you want me to jump in here, but I hear you.
Was Osho a creep? Can we say that? Rick's TM teacher, was he a creep? He was a creep. They still got all these people that are still in TM. Go read the guy's history. He was doing inappropriate stuff all over the place. Why can't we just call this out when we don't, when we act like, well, you know, not sure. I don't think it serves anyone.
Yeah. I mean, if I honestly, right. So when I'm not doing something public or writing, I'm working in a 100% hermetically sealed confidential container. That's the ethic of my profession. Right. So I know a lot. I say a lot that only gets translated into vague principles and books that protect people, because that's me being ethical. But a few years ago, I dealt with the fallout of a spiritual scandal that resulted in a young man's death. I mean, it gets really real. You know, it's one thing like when people are hurt and all the usual power struggles and the sex scandals, and I dealt with this 20 years in my private practice and as an author. But then when people start getting killed, right, and dying, that's a whole nother level. And it's sobered me in moments beyond measure, right? And I am always uncompromised in speaking what I feel in those situations.
So what do you feel? What do you feel? What do you feel about Osho?
What I feel about Osho is, well, I'm not going to base it just on Wild Wild Country, right? Which is our new fad, right? There's a new documentary based on something that.
I've studied it for quite some time and read many accounts. I thought they did an excellent job. So anything else you want to bring to the table? I get that there's plenty of people who said they had an incredible experience with Osho. I don't think that matters. I mean, I think that's what I'm getting at is that. So tell me how you break it down.
I break it down in that there, how do I break it down? It's really tricky. Like I'm going to jump over to another controversial example, which would be Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, right? Who, for people who don't know, he was a Tibetan Buddhist master. He was an alcoholic. He was a womanizer. He probably did more single-handedly to bring Tibetan Buddhism to the West than anyone else ever. His closest students were people like Pema Chodron, Reggie Ray, some extraordinary teachers. He founded Naropa University, right, in Boulder, Colorado. So this man, right, who was clearly flawed, and there's wonderful books out about, you know, from his wife who calls it all out. I mean, I don't think most people are confused about that. And yet, right, Pema Chodron alone, like the tens of thousands of people who have still managed to benefit, right, in spite of what you would call a creep. It doesn't make him less creepy. It doesn't make any person he hurt, you know, less affected. It doesn't make it any more right. But there's a certain amount of complexity in these situations, because sometimes there's a creepy teacher and there's really good students who are earnest and burning with passion and eager for discernment. So in spite of this creepy teacher, they derive tremendous benefit. And then the teacher may have a scandal and it falls apart. And then these people band together and become lifelong allies on the path and support each other and become more discerning because of it. So I guess I want to say that there is, while there's an aspect of black and white, I mean, I don't hesitate to call right from wrong. There's another layer of complexity that coexists, not, you know, when you coexist, little new agey thing, but that coexists because, and where I bring it back to is like, we have to, if we're going to enter into these spiritual pursuits, we have to take deep inventory of ourselves. I say in my new book, I would like every single yoga teacher and serious practitioner to undergo a series of depth psychology in their lives. Because if we do that, and we understand our own motivations, the chances of us falling into a scandalous situation are infinitesimally reduced. Like they're reduced massively, right? I began my spiritual search at 18, 19, stumbled into all of these replica, you know, these teachers that replicated everything screwed up inside of my own psyche. Nowadays, I'm not the least bit worried about falling into those kind of hands because I understand what's motivating me and I understand where I'm going to fall. And so it's like, that's the empowerment, like take it back. And that's what all of my books are about. Take it back into your own hands. And then you become the discerning person on the path, and your chances of falling into something that's going to harm you at that level are very small.
That was great, Marianne. I really appreciate how you're holding these two separate ideas together. One is that we have to take control. It's kind of like the new model for medicine, right? You can no longer go to the doctor and say, "Doc, what should I do?" Man, if you're not Googling your butt off before you go there, forget it. And we all know that. It's a shared responsibility. And that's what I hear you saying about how our spirituality needs to be. It needs to be a shared responsibility. We don't go give our power to Osho. We don't go give our power to the Catholic Church, to anybody. There's enough great information, including the kind of stuff that you're talking about, that allows us to create our own path, follow our own path, and find people that can help us along the path without destroying us and pushing us two steps back. So I love what you just said, and I love how we can find that in your books. So here's the third kind of area that I like to cover, and I'm going to tee up for this discussion, and that's that in this process, this skeptical process, we're following the data. Science is going to help us, even though science is clunky and outdated with their crazy model of consciousness, which is just absurd. Still, the tools we want, like you bring forth in your book and the studies and showing the benefits, are great. The conspiracy is important. We can't just take everything as it's given to us. We have to look deeper. But then the third point for me is to find the deep spirituality, the spirituality that we're talking about, our personal spirituality, beyond religion, beyond dogma. But in particular, what I think would be interesting to dialogue with you about is the aspect of the spiritual that does marry with the non-dual and the yogic in a way that I think you and I can talk about in kind of an interesting new way. I mentioned before that I really appreciate the work that Rick does at Buddha at the Gas Pump. And I just want to tee up two quotes that I think will bring this idea home. One is from Amma, of course, the hugging saint, this beautiful person that works tirelessly, you know, 18 hours a day, hugging people and digging latrines in India. But the point, and people might get tired of hearing me say this, but I think it's such a profound point. So the devotees go to Amma and they go, "Amma, you know, you say that we're not of this world and that spirituality is bigger, and yet you're working tirelessly for this world. You know, you're working so hard. What is it?" It Amma supposedly says, "World? What world?" I get that. That propels me forward in a way that I guess I kind of would, I don't want to say take issue, but I'd contrast that with a quote that you had in your book that says, people come to me saying they want truth, and what they really want is happiness. Mm-hmm. So let's play around with that idea. How much are we to be in this world, and how much are we to be not in this world?
Yeah, so Rick, right, who I very much enjoy collaborating with in any of the ways that I do, he's exploring more of this non-dual approach to psychotherapy. The traditions that I've studied in, both as a Jewish person in my studies of Buddhism and my studies of yoga, have been what's more in the tantric traditions. And I know...
But who cares? We can't go back. We can't go back. We just talked about that. The Jewish tradition, let's talk about the Torah and how it's all bullshit and the whole Yahweh thing was just created. We can go back and trace it. I've talked to the scholars that can tell you, you know, when...
Wait, I'm in the middle of a sentence and I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, the point is, I don't understand the distinction when people say, wait a minute, I'm from Tantra, so we're coming.
What I was going to say is that what I appreciate about the Tantric perspective that I do find in Judaism, and I do find in Buddhism, and I do find in yoga, I understand the religious bullshit and all of that, is that transformation takes place like here and in this world. So I'm not about trying to leave this world. I can appreciate the what world, you know, where Amma is going with that. But even when I was living in an ashram and as a young woman, a girlfriend and I, we were 25 and we used to steal out in the woods and say like, all this talk about getting off the wheel. Like, I like the wheel. I don't want to get off the wheel. Why are we trying to get off the wheel? So I've always approached spirituality as of this world. And what I like about the mystic side of the Judaism that I do participate in is it takes it all back here. It's not about leaving this or transcending this. It's taking it all and bringing it here. So the point about bringing in a tantric perspective is it says that you know, all of life can be used not only for the purpose of transformation, but as the expression of transformation. And again,
transformation to what I think always implied in that. The funny thing I find in that is what's implied is that it is a transformation to what Amma is pointing to, what every spiritual master in Buddhism and Hinduism has pointed to, and what a lot of the Christian mystics have pointed to as well. And I'm sure some of the Kabbalic and Jewish mystics as well, is that fundamentally, we're transcending past this material world. So if you're saying this is the stopping point and you want to stay here and play for a while, I get that. So go ahead. I'll let you respond to that and I'll tee up another one.
Yeah, it's not even like I want to sit here and play for a while. It's like, this is where we live. This is where our relationships happen. This is where whatever inner work we're doing expresses itself. And as you were saying earlier, right, it's very clear that a large part of our current world is disintegrated and disconnected. So I think, you know, what I appreciate about a lot of the traditions bringing in social engagement, social activism, it's just saying like, let's take all of that. I'm not trying to get out of here, because I'll get out of here from the time that I'm dead, you know. Who knows what happens after, right? Like we're here now. So I think that the process that we're in is most effectively expressed here and now, and not only with the people around us, but that's the capacity that can be brought in to change structures and to you know, to make a difference in real lives, right? Amma lives in some other world, but she spends her days hugging individuals who are suffering.
Exactly. Well, I think that's the point, and we can kind of return to that, but I'll make the same point in a different way. Another great quote I love from Rick's show, and an episode that really slipped under the radar for a lot of people, but for me is a profoundness to what, a profundity to what this truck driver who never meditated, never practiced any non-dual practice, but just thought about things deeply and came to the conclusion that it's not going to work out. That's his profound contribution. Mm. And I think it's a deep one. It's not going to work out. So all my plans for what I want for my kids, they're not going to work out. All my plans on my relationship with my wife and where that should go, where my business should go, for what I should do with my health, none of it is going to work out. It's certainly not going to work out exactly the way that I like. And if I really get into it deeply, I'm going to realize it's really not going to work out at all. And the reason it's not going to work out is because of what Amma said. World, what world? I mean, the science, if we go back to following the data, the best model we probably have for what's going on is some form of idealism, some form of consciousness being fundamental, of us creating this reality. So, of course, it's not going to work out. Doesn't that put a different spin on what you're saying in terms of, well, you know, I like being on the wheel. I like trying to be happy. I like all the rest of that.
Didn't say I like trying to be happy. You know, I'm grateful to be
alive. I like trying to be happy. I try and be happy.
Being happy, I like, but trying to be happy can be a real pain, right? And being disappointed when I'm not. So I don't know if it puts another spin on it. I just, you know, I think what I've always done in my books, but in my life is that we just, and what readers have appreciated is that we take these big concepts and just let them be about you and I, and not high and above and where other people live and where we suppose that we're going to imagine to get to, but like just start here. So I very much appreciate what that man says. And
yeah. I do too, because I have to say that, you know, I guess the reason I reacted to the kind of non-dual versus tantric stuff, that supposed juxtaposition, is that I don't see it. I see what Norio is saying as being deeply and profoundly putting me in the now. I mean, here's a guy who talks about, you know, realizing that it's not going to work out and that bringing him to where he can sit with his children, and rather than tell them, he can sit and just cry and just say, wow, you know, I can be there for you right now because I don't have any expectations about how it's going to be or what it's going to be, because I've given up on the fact that it's going to work out in some particular way. So I don't see this, you know, I'm tantric, I'm non-dual. I mean, if people are hung up in that, I think they've missed the point.
I go back to a moment when you say, you know, people getting hung up and I'm tantric, I'm not dual. I had a very humbling moment in response to that. And it was about more than 20 years ago. And I was interviewing Joan Halifax for this book, Halfway Up the Mountain, that I wrote in my 20s. And it was a book about premature claims to enlightenment. And I was really making a passionate point about people's over-identification with their spirituality and their spiritual resume and all these things. And she stopped me and she said, look, she said, I teach Buddhism to prisoners on death row. And she says, like, that's really like, that's where the rubber meets the road. And she says, for me, when people are like dressing up as enlightened or this or that, she said, it's like when you were a young girl and you play dress up in your mother's closet. And she said, it was just a stage. You know, like don't even get hung up on that. And it was super helpful. Because I had a real like axe to grind with people who were caught up in this or that. And believe me, you know, I get flooded with it. And then in some ways then we're gonna keep growing, you know, and hopefully in a good direction with good helpers, and things are gonna happen in our lives. We're gonna meet old age, sickness, and death. You know, somebody's going to die. We're going to get sick, and we're going to get chances for real wake-up calls, and we will make use of them or not make use of them. But some things happen developmentally, right? By just growing up in the path, growing up in life.
Yeah. I mean, hit the mat. I have such a reaction when, you know, if somebody says, I'm teaching Zen meditation to prisoners on death row, that's where the rubber meets the road. Bullshit. Somebody's teaching yoga to middle-aged housewives out in ritzy, ritzy Rancho Santa Fe where I live. That's where the rubber meets the road. To think that somebody on death row is closer to the road than any of us who step on a yoga mat anywhere, I think misses the point.
But that wasn't the point. That wasn't the point.
But that's what she said.
No, I said that she said that's where the rubber meets the road, but the point that I heard isn't the point that you heard.
Well, help me again. Help me succinctly.
It's like you were saying that, you know, you got caught when I said something about Tantra, and people like, I practice this. And I'm only saying that I hear so much of this. And when I was a younger practitioner, when I saw people doing goddess yoga and all these things, it just drove me crazy. I had like big, strong feelings about it. And as I grow up and life humbles me, I just have a little bit more patience for people to move through stages and hopefully, you know, support them with information they didn't have and hopefully, you know, let people grow up. And if they don't, I place my attention somewhere else. So she was just pointing out, you know, I was like vehemently, you know, upset about people who are claiming enlightenment prematurely. And she's like, whatever, you know, like they'll grow up or they won't. So that was much more of the point.
Okay.
I may push another button, but it's not that one.
But it is that one, but that's okay. Because you said that, you know, Rick does, these were your words. I'll edit this out. But you said, you know, Rick does this non-dual stuff. And I come from this Tantra perspective. So you set up the duality, not me. And I'm saying, I think that duality is wrought with problems. You know, it's like when we talked earlier on, and maybe I won't edit this part out, you know, the them part, you know, oh, well, I don't like talking about us versus them in psychology. Oh, really? Tee it up for me. I'll talk about us versus them all day long, because people who believe in the neuroscience model of consciousness are, to a certain extent, in some kind of mind control program to control our kids and to convince them that, you know, pharmacological solutions to their problems are the way to pursue it. And it is a battle for a particular mindset. If you want to talk about religion, you want to say there's no us versus them, then I'm going to say, yeah, there is an us versus them. And we have a pope that's so attached to the pedophilia community inside the Catholic Church that it's scary, and his closest aide for a lifetime aide is on trial right now in Australia with over 100 kids that have come forward and said this guy repeatedly raped them. And as we know, pedophiles, when there's smoke like that, there's fire. When a pope has surrounded himself with a bunch of people who are proven pedophiles, then he cannot separate that out. I don't have friends who are pedophiles. Mm-hmm. If I have a friend and I find out they're a pedophile, they're no longer my friend. Mm-hmm. We cannot assume with everything that's going on that this pope is not a pedophile. In fact, we should assume the opposite. We should assume that he is until he convincingly presents it as that not being true. So you want to say us versus them? I'll step forward and say us versus them. I think we have a pedo pope. So us versus them does work sometimes. It is necessary sometimes. And you're about that, you know, and I understand you have a professional obligation and an ethical obligation and this and that. I'm just saying, you know, it's okay to call out some of this stuff too.
Yeah.
Okay. What works, what doesn't? This I thought would be interesting as kind of a way to round up this discussion and bring you into kind of my world, Skeptico. You know, here's a guy, a professor of biology, awesome guy, Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, The Science of Spiritual Practices. Rupert both wrote the foreword to my book. He's written so many fantastic books, is highly regarded. He's a Christian. We had a little bit of a discussion about that, but you know, hey, here's the science of spiritual practices. You know, pilgrimages are a good idea. Meditation, prayer is a good idea. Does this work? Is this the path that people should pursue? I'll tee up the rest as long as I'm at it. My other friend, Gordon White, is into chaos magic. Hey, chaos magic. That's the way. That's what works. Here are my buddies, Tony Robbins, the Iceman. I don't think Wim Hof gets enough credit as the incredible yogi that he is. So I do ice baths all the time. It reminds me that I am not my body. When you're sitting in 35 degree water, you got to get that mental focus that you are not really there. Your presence is there, but your consciousness is separate from that. And I think, let's see if I edit it in. And I think certainly that's what you're offering up. You're saying, this is what works. Yoga, in the way that you're talking about it being practiced, can work for people. So let's, in the time we have left, dialogue about what works and what doesn't. Because I think, Mariana, people are wondering, you know, should I look at chaos magic? I have a lot of people listen to the show who are into chaos magic and say, wait a minute, why not chaos magic? That should be my starting point, you know? Or people coming from a religious background like Rupert and saying, Christianity, if I stick to it, you know, that's going to work for me. What works? What doesn't? You're pragmatic. Your book is pragmatic. It's in a lot of ways, it's a toolkit kind of book. How do people address this? What works? What doesn't?
What works is becoming very intelligent practitioners, right? Very intelligent people on the path. And for me, like, I don't see spiritual life in the West working without psychology. I don't see spiritual communities functioning without the teachers and students doing depth psychological work, however they're going to do it, especially when we're importing an Eastern tradition. If we're going to drop it in the West, psychology has the tools and the practices that are going to support things that Eastern importations are not going to support.
But don't we have to get past a little bit the spiritual relativism? Like, you know, well, it's all everyone, we're all doing yoga, really. Where I hear this is with chaos magic, you know, and Gordon White, I have the utmost respect for him. He's been on the show multiple times. But a lot of times the chaos magic people will say, in one respect, quite correctly, and in another respect, in a completely meaningless way, hey, we're all doing magic all the time. What they mean is there is a reality to this extended consciousness that does seem to be occupied by spirits, for lack of a better word. If we're honest about it, every spiritual tradition talks about this. We can't deny it. Certainly Christianity, Judaism, the Buddhists, the Hindus talk about this spiritual realm and there being spirits that are interacting. So we're interacting with them. So why wouldn't we choose to interact with them in a certain way? Try and manage that relationship in a way. So that is a very specific way of saying, here's what works. What some chaos magician folks like to say, though, is that then as soon as you say, well, what about this? What about that? They go, well, you know, your yoga psychology is effectively magic at work, you know, or this. So don't this relativism, I think, can be a little confusing. What is there specifically about the yoga psychology blend that you've found that makes it different from these other paths? And in your opinion, makes it better? I mean, I think your somatic stuff is spot on. I think it's an important distinction that people can feel and grab onto, is that stuff gets caught in the body in ways that we don't understand, and your practice can change that. I mean, that's my answer to the question, but what's your answer?
I don't know. I don't know how much more to add to that. I mean, I obviously like think that what I'm offering here is the, you know, the most effective practices and ways to blend these two particular traditions. But I don't think that everyone in the world should be doing yoga and psychology. This is my first book about yoga and psychology. My other books are about how to support people to most effectively have a fruitful and a fruitful journey with the most unnecessary suffering on whatever path they choose.
So, Mariana, this is terrific. Again, I think I could really, really highly recommend this book as a practicing yogi and someone who has experienced firsthand the psychological aspect to yoga. I think this book explores it in such a terrific way. And what really impresses me is that people who pick up this good book are going to find practical ways to take these ideas and take them into their practice and to try them out in the way you're talking about. So, you know, we've covered that. We haven't really talked about your other books, but people can find those on your website. And I also want people to understand more of what you do in terms of therapy work if they feel drawn to you in any way. So in the time we have left, can you tell us more about, one, where they can get the book, about your website, Real Spirituality, and about your therapy practice?
Sure, thanks. So realspirituality.com and yogaandpsyche.com, you can link them, you can find them through each other or just putting my name in Google. Yogaandpsyche.com is much more about this material specifically. It has a whole library of all this academic research, lots and lots of free resources to pursue that specifically. And then as a clinician, I do psychotherapy and I do spiritual counseling. So I work in person from my home in Fairfax, California, and I work through video anywhere in the world.
Awesome. Again, our guest has been Mariana Kaplan. Mariana, thank you so much for joining me on Skeptico.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Mariana Kaplan for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I guess I'd tee up from this interview is, from the spiritual seeker standpoint, what relationship is there between the body and what we might do with it, like with these yoga poses or breathing, and connecting with this extended consciousness / deep spirituality? Man, that's a big question. A lot to pull apart there. And that's one of the things that I'm interested in exploring in this show. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Send me an email, contact the show, join the Skeptico forum. However you get there, let me know what you think about that question, about this episode, about other episodes. I love to hear from all of you. I really do. So that's going to do it for this episode. I have a number of good episodes coming up. I think they're in the queue. They're in the hopper. They're coming out. A bunch of other stuff too. It just takes time. Stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.